Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Brian Patrick Miller? First, I'll look at the background of this case, including the timeline of the crimes, then offer my analysis. Brian Patrick Miller was born on October 24, 1972, in Trenton, Michigan. At one point when he was young, he lived in Hawaii with his parents. His father was killed in a motorcycle collision. After this, Brian and his mother moved to Phoenix, Arizona. Brian's mother found work as a detention officer for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. In May 1989, when Brian was 16, he stabbed a 24-year-old woman named Celeste Bentley after they both stepped off a bus. Celeste ran to a nearby store for help. She was taken to a hospital and survived. Brian was arrested at the scene and charged with aggravated assault. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to a juvenile detention facility. He was to remain there until he turned 18. In 1990, prior to Brian's release, his mother found a disturbing note that he had written about kidnapping a girl. He specifically mentioned decapitating the victim and preserving the head. Brian's mother was highly concerned about the note, mostly because of the murder part. She gave it to the police and informed them that Brian was not allowed to move back in with her after he was released. She was happy with the current state of her head, specifically how it was attached to her body. Brian ended up in a halfway house in Phoenix. On May 26, 1992, when Brian was still in the halfway house, a 13-year-old girl named Brandy Lynn Myers left home and went door to door for a fundraiser. She never returned home, and no trace of her was ever found. Brandy lived just a few blocks away from the halfway house. Years later, when questioned about Brandy's disappearance, Brian denied any involvement. On November 8, 1992, at about 7 p.m., a woman named Angela Brosso left her apartment to ride a bicycle near a canal. Her boyfriend remained at the apartment to bake her a birthday cake. Angela was going to turn 22 the next day. Brian Miller attacked Angela as she was riding her bicycle. He committed an assault of a sexual nature, stabbed her to death, and decapitated her. When Angela failed to return as expected, her boyfriend looked for her without success. He notified the police and reported her missing. The police found Angela's torso in a field near her apartment. Her head was found 11 days later in a canal about 1.5 miles away from where her torso was found. Her bicycle was never located. The police had no idea who committed the murder. On September 21, 1993, Brian Miller attacked a 17-year-old named Melanie Burness. Melanie was on a bicycle near a canal when Brian stabbed her to death. The day after the murder, her body was found by the same canal where Angela's head had been found. Brian left his DNA on both victims, but the police did not know who the DNA belonged to. The case caused a lot of fear in Phoenix. The homicides came to be known as the canal murders. In 1994, the police received a tip about Brian Miller, but they never bothered to follow up. The canal murders case went cold. There were no more leads that the police had any interest in investigating. Brian went on with his life as if he had not committed any murders. He met a woman named Amy in 1996. They married in 1998 and moved to the state of Washington. The couple had a daughter in 2000. Amy would later claim that Brian mentioned murdering a girl in Phoenix. The circumstances that he described matched the Randy Lynn Myers case. Amy did not initially say anything because she wanted to be a good wife, was afraid of Brian, and was not certain that he was telling the truth. In 2002, when Brian was still in Washington, he stabbed a woman named Melissa Ruiz Ramirez. It's not exactly clear what happened. Melissa said that she had accepted a ride from Brian. He took her to his workplace so she could use the phone. When she was on the phone, he attacked her with a 12-inch knife. Brian said that he was at work when Melissa asked to use the phone. She then attacked him, and he stabbed her in self-defense. Brian was arrested and charged with first-degree assault with a deadly weapon. He was acquitted in December of 2002. He moved back to Arizona. Brian and his wife divorced in 2006. Brian obtained custody of his daughter. To make a living, he worked at an Amazon warehouse. As far as recreation, Brian would dress up as a character he called the Zombie Hunter. He purchased an old police car and modified it to look like some type of zombie attack vehicle. A zombie mannequin could be seen in the back seat of the car. Brian attended various comic book and other similar conventions. He posed for photographs with people, including police officers. This Zombie Hunter persona made Brian a local quasi-celebrity. Brian may have had a desire to hunt the undead, but as it turns out, the resurrection of the Canal Murders case would be his undoing. In late 2014 and early 2015, after many improvements with DNA testing, the police used genetic genealogy to narrow down the number of potential suspects. One possible match was Brian Patrick Miller. After they tricked Brian with a fake job offer to obtain his DNA, the police were able to match it to the DNA found on the victims in the Canal murders. Brian was arrested and charged in connection with the deaths of both Angela and Melanie. His trial started in October 2022. Brian opted for a bench trial. The judge would decide his fate. There was no jury. Brian's defense attorneys did not deny that he was the killer, but said that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. On June 7, 2023, Brian Miller was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, as well as other offenses. He was sentenced to the death penalty plus 24 years in prison. Unfortunately for Brian, he doesn't get to choose which part of that sentence to serve first. Brian later told the media that he was not happy on death row. The food was not great, and his prison cell was very cold. The prison should brace themselves for a 1-star review on Yelp from Brian. If he's already unhappy with the food and temperature, he's really going to be displeased with the death row checkout policy. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number 1. Brian's defense attorneys argued that Brian may have committed the murders because he was treated badly by his mother. She died in 2010, therefore did not testify at his trial. According to Brian, he experienced physical harm at the hands of his mother starting at age 5. In addition, she had an intense interest in violent and adults-only movies. She would allow Brian to watch these movies. Anger was a common emotion for Brian's mother. She would regularly tell him that she was angry, that he lived, and her husband died. The judge believed that the claims of mistreatment were true. The defense was able to prove that Brian had suffered at the hands of his mother. The next step was to connect this mistreatment to mental illness. This brings me to item number 2. The defense had mental health professionals evaluate Brian. Some of them believed that Brian was sadistic, suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and may have had autism spectrum disorder. These conclusions are not really that surprising considering the evidence, but the clinicians also believed that Brian suffered from dissociative amnesia. They claimed that he did not retain any memory of committing the murders. Let's take a closer look at the concept of dissociative amnesia. This disorder is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, along with 2 other dissociative disorders: dissociative identity disorder and depersonalization derealization disorder. Like all dissociative disorders, dissociative amnesia is controversial. These disorders are based on the psychoanalytic worldview, which is an intriguing theory as far as conducting therapy, but impossible to prove. Many researchers approach this diagnostic category with a good deal of skepticism. If dissociative amnesia actually exists at all, it is exceedingly rare. There are four diagnostic criteria for dissociative amnesia. One, an inability to recall important autobiographical information. This is inconsistent with normal forgetting and often confined to specific traumatic events. Two, the symptoms cause clinically significant distress. Three, the symptoms are not caused through substance use or a neurological condition. And four, the disturbance cannot be better explained by dissociative identity disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, somatic symptom disorder, or neurocognitive disorder. Some people defend the idea of dissociative amnesia by noting that regular amnesia is real. But this argument is conflating two terms. Amnesia is a real condition, but dissociative amnesia is a particular type of amnesia which has a specific conceptualization. Here is the theory behind this disorder. When a person endures a traumatic event, their brain can be overwhelmed. They simply can't process all the information related to the terrible nature of the trauma. In order to protect itself, the brain engages a safety mechanism called dissociation. It separates the victim's personality from their memories. The memories are safely stored in the unconscious mind. When the stress of the trauma dissipates, these memories become fully available to the victim. The individual can function normally and everything is fine. This protective mechanism is temporary and the memory loss should only last for a few days. Sometimes, however, the protective mechanism gets stuck, like maybe one of the brain technicians forgot to oil a hinge or something. This means that the memories can stay locked away for weeks, months, or even years. This is an interesting theory, but research has not been able to detect indications of this disorder using brain scans or other similar instruments. There is no scientific support for the idea of dissociative amnesia, regardless of the form, whether it's referring to a specific memory loss, like a traumatic memory, or a more general loss. That doesn't mean that dissociative amnesia doesn't exist. It just means there's no scientific way to demonstrate its existence. Item number three, do I think that Brian's dissociative amnesia defense was valid? In clinical practice, therapists tend to give the diagnosis of dissociative amnesia when a person claims to have memory loss, but there is no other explanation available for that memory loss. Many clinicians who frequently diagnose this condition have a tendency to always believe what their clients tell them. Perhaps this is what happened in Brian's case. For example, one of the clinicians who testified on his behalf talked about how it was incredibly dysfunctional not to remember something as egregious as murders, almost like it did not occur to the clinician that lying was a possibility. There was also a reference to multiple identities. The clinician argued that part of Brian was violent, but another part wasn't. These two parts didn't know about each other. The multiple identity argument frequently finds its way into these types of high-profile cases. I find it to be extremely convenient for Brian that he can't remember the two murders, but he can remember stabbing a victim before the murders and supposedly defending himself by stabbing another person after the murders. In a sense, Brian is saying that he can't remember what he did, but he definitely remembers that he didn't commit any murders. How could he be so positive? If he didn't remember, there's no way he could be certain. In my opinion, Brian was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. His dissociative amnesia defense was not believable. Now moving to my final item, number four. What do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. From an early age, Brian developed a desire to dominate women and had fantasies about committing murder. He also developed psychopathic and narcissistic characteristics. Brian was manipulative, fearless, deceptive, grandiose, angry, and had a sense of entitlement. He was also impulsive, irresponsible, and lacked empathy. In his case, these traits probably developed due to traumatic events caused by his mother. Brian tried to restrain his dark fantasies and his other negative characteristics, but he wasn't always successful. This resulted in him attacking women. At other times, his fantasies expressed through means which were legal, like his zombie hunter persona. Just like his fantasies, Brian's impulsivity was evident across many facets of his life. For example, when the police searched his house, they found that it was full of garbage from floor to ceiling. There was a path to move around, but everything else was covered. Brian knew the difference between right and wrong throughout his entire life, and eventually decided to stop committing crimes. But his past came back to haunt him, much like a hunter of zombies.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.